We're going to actually pull out a member of the Naples community to be our first speaker. Bob Levy received his PhD in business from American University in 1966. Bob's 65 now, so I guess he was 7 years old when he got the PhD. Bob went on to found and be CEO of CDA Investment Technologies, a leading provider of investment information and financial software, until he stepped down in 1991 to pursue his true passion, the defense of the Constitution. And Bob enrolled at George Mason University Law School. I think that there were probably some students who were surprised and maybe glad to see an old guy in their classes. But Bob was a tiger. He went on to be the articles editor of the Law Review and ultimately valedictorian of his law school class, following which he served as clerk for a year for Judge Royce Lamberth of the D.C. District Court, followed by a year as clerk for Judge Douglas Ginsburg on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. After that, Bob joined Cato as a senior fellow in constitutional studies and ultimately chaired the board of Cato for 14 years, seven of which overlap with my time as CEO, during which I can attest to Bob's significant value as a leader and as a friend to me. Bob is going to give you a preview of seven important cases that are pending at the Supreme Court, and another great example of Cato's influence. One of the most important cases involves Chevron deference, the review of that doctrine, and former Solicitor General Paul Clement cited Cato's amicus brief in that case twice during oral argument. With that, I will yield the floor and welcome Bob Levy.
So we always have to deal with the electronics first. Many thanks to Peter for the kind words. For the past 9 years, Peter has been Cato's CEO. He's also been a member of our board for 10 years and an incredibly generous donor for more than 20 years. And it's fair to say that under Peter's leadership, Cato has reinforced its reputation for intellectual rigor, for promoting libertarian principles, and for having a significant impact on public policy. So we at Cato are indeed fortunate to have enlisted Peter as our chief executive officer. And of course, Peter and I and everyone else at Cato, we are immensely grateful for your support. So it's great to be here at the Ritz. My favorite Ritz story, some of which you may have heard, is about a few Naples friends who agreed to meet every 10 years for a grand reunion. And it all started when they were 50 years old. So they met for the first time and they voted on where to have dinner. And they picked the Ritz because the waitresses were attractive and wore these provocative outfits. 10 years later, age 60, they met for their second reunion and they voted again to have dinner at the Ritz. Because the food and the wine is terrific. Fast forward another 10 years, they're 70 years old, and they meet and they vote to have dinner here at the Ritz because it has elevators and wheelchair access. And then another decade, and they all turn 80, they meet and they vote to have dinner at the Ritz because they had never been here before. The funniest stories are the ones that are very close to reality. So today, as you heard, I'm going to preview in highly condensed and rapid fashion seven of the major cases now pending before the Supreme Court. So let's begin with a case about reigning in the administrative state. And by that, I mean the exercise of legislative power by executive departments and independent regulatory agencies. We have Washington, D.C.'s alphabet agencies working overtime, HHS regulating healthcare, the FCC controlling the internet, CFPB enforcing Dodd-Frank, just to name a few. And to grasp the scope of the problem, consider that those agencies now dwarf Congress when it comes to making rules that control what Americans can do. The rules are printed in the Code of Federal Regulations, which is now more than 200 bound volumes, about four times as large as the U.S. Code containing all the laws passed by Congress. In the final year of the Obama administration, Congress enacted almost 3,000 pages of laws. That same year, federal agencies churned out 32 times as much, a total of 97,000 pages of regulations. So our first pending case is called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, which addresses what's called the Chevron Doctrine. Part one of the doctrine goes like this. If Congress has passed a law that directly addresses an issue, and the intent of Congress is clear, then the statute controls. But part two, if the statute is silent or ambiguous, the courts will defer to any reasonable interpretation by the agency. So in the Loper case, the court is going to decide whether to overrule the Chevron doctrine or at least clarify whether imprecise statutory provisions warrant deference by the court to agency interpretations. Now, that may sound like a minor matter, but the Chevron doctrine has been targeted by conservatives and libertarians for decades because, we argue, it lets Congress off the hook. It gives far too much discretion to unelected officials. Over the years, Chevron has been the fuel driving the administrative state. And as you've heard, and as I'm pleased to report, Cato's amicus brief opposing the Chevron doctrine was cited twice during Supreme Court oral argument. Hopefully, it'll be Chevron. Rest in peace. So next, we revisit the perpetual controversy over gun control. In Rahimi versus United States, the court will decide whether a federal statute barring possession of firearms by persons under a domestic violence restraining order flouts the Second Amendment. Now, Rahimi is clearly a bad dude with a record of violence, but the 2022 Bruin decision, that's just 2 years ago, directs that any gun restrictions must be consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. So unless the court can find an analogous regulation that existed in 1791 when the Second Amendment was ratified, it may be forced either to throw out Rahimi's conviction for gun possession or to modify its Bruin standard, which is less than 2 years old. Prior to Bruin, the court followed a two-step approach in Second Amendment cases. Step one, examine whether a proposed regulation is consistent with the text, history, and tradition of gun laws. Step two, assess the costs and benefits of firearms restrictions. Bruin employed step one only and concluded that New York did not meet the history-based test. And accordingly, the court in Bruin invalidated a 1913 New York law and held that Americans have a right to carry outside the home for self-defense without proving that they had a special need to do so. Now, that was a big deal, both because Bruin was the first case to expressly extend the right to carry beyond the home, and because the court overhauled its Second Amendment framework. So we will see if the court backs off from its exclusive reliance on history and tradition. I personally would hope that it will do so. Okay, moving on to a completely different topic, Moore versus United States. This is about taxation of unrealized income. More specifically, whether Congress can tax income earned overseas but not repatriated to the United States. Basically, the court authorizes three types of federal taxes. Income taxes are specifically authorized by the 16th Amendment. Indirect taxes on asset transfers, like sales taxes, excise taxes, for example, a federal gasoline tax, they have to be uniform across the states. And direct taxes, those that are applied to individuals or their property, they have to be apportioned to the states by population. And that's why we don't have a federal property tax. So the Moores in this case argue that a tax on their foreign earnings is not an income tax because the earnings haven't been realized through repatriation to the United States. And they argue that a property tax on those earnings cannot qualify as a direct tax because it would not be apportioned by population. Now, what's really going on here is that Elizabeth Warren would like to tax all wealth attributable to unrealized gains. She hopes that this case will advance her trillion-dollar redistributionist agenda, even though until now, federal taxes on property have been deemed unconstitutional by most legal experts. Never mind that a wealth tax would create numerous other problems. How do you value illiquid assets, such as art, privately held companies? Whether you should include the present value of pension benefits, and why the same income should be taxed a fourth time when it's already been subject to taxes on corporate earnings, dividends when they're distributed, and the investor's estate. No wonder that Sweden and Denmark, Finland, the Netherlands all tried and then abandoned wealth taxes. Both the Constitution and good economics say we should follow their lead. The next two cases involve content filtering by social media companies. The first is actually a consolidation of two lawsuits, one from Florida, one from Texas. Liberals, as you've heard, want more filtering to screen out what they believe to be misinformation and offensive speech. Conservatives, they want less filtering because of a perceived, maybe even an actual, bias against conservative views. And as a result, there's been considerable pressure on Congress from the left and the right to impose new rules for content screening. But the two sides are very far apart on the changes they'd like to see. And naturally, any government meddling is going to have First Amendment implications. When content modification rules were challenged in Texas and Florida, federal appellate courts came up with opposite holdings. And so the Supremes are going to have to resolve the difference. In the Texas case, two trade associations want the Supreme Court to overturn a law that bars social media companies from blocking content based on a user's viewpoint. They argue that the law abridges the First Amendment rights of these companies to remove hate speech and political disinformation and violent videos and other harmful content. The U.S. Court of Appeals upheld the Texas regulations, but the trade groups had better success here in Florida. Here, they challenged the state's Stop Social Media Censorship Act, which was passed after Trump was suspended from Twitter in the wake of January the 6th. The act provided that social media companies could not ban political candidates or journalistic enterprises. And the appellate court in that case invalidated the law on First Amendment grounds. Whenever speech is restricted based on its content, the government has a heavy burden to justify its regulations. And I doubt that either Texas or Florida have met that burden. There is another social media case pending, and the issue there is whether the Biden administration improperly pressured tech companies to take down posts about public health and about election integrity. The appellate court concluded that the White House and the CDC likely coerced the platforms to make moderation decisions. And that is the key question. Was there coercion? The Republican attorneys general in Louisiana and Missouri who brought the case relied on a well-settled legal principle. The government is prohibited by the Constitution from forcing people to express certain views. And they may not circumvent that prohibition by compelling private parties to act as the government's censor. Still, it is equally well settled that government officials can advocate for the public policies they prefer. That is the essence of politics. So it's okay to jawbone social media companies, but it's not okay to compel their cooperation. The Supreme Court will be telling us whether the Biden administration has crossed that line. I suspect that it did. Next, let's turn to the presidential election and the debate over Donald Trump's immunity from prosecution. That question arises out of his indictment related to the events of January 6th. Trump is going to push as many pretrial motions as his lawyers can conjure up. One of his goals is to delay the final verdict until the 2024 election is over. And then, if he wins, he could order the Justice Department to drop the case. Well, in a unanimous opinion on February 6th, just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C. rejected Trump's claim that former presidents are immune from criminal prosecution for their past acts unless they are first impeached and convicted by Congress. That, in my view, was the correct decision. Trump's lawyers conceded that he could be prosecuted after he was impeached and convicted, and ergo, there is no absolute immunity. It's just a matter of process, and nothing in the Constitution supports Trump's assertion that impeachment and conviction must precede prosecution. Moreover, I think it's highly disputable that his attempts to cancel certified election results indeed qualified as official acts. On February 13th, a week ago, Trump was granted Supreme Court review. Meanwhile, the justices put the appellate court ruling on hold and directed the government to respond to the immunity question by February 20th, which is today. So for now, the previously set March 4th trial date has been delayed, and we will see how quickly the Supremes issue their ruling on the immunity issue. The final case I'd like to talk about is Trump v. Anderson, which is Colorado's attempt to disqualify Trump from running for president by excluding him from the state's 2024 ballot. And that idea was introduced in a law review article by two conservative law professors. And then it was endorsed in a 4-3 decision by 7 Democratic appointees on the Colorado Supreme Court. At issue is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It was ratified after the Civil War to stop former Confederate officials from holding U.S. office. That section says in relevant part, and I quote, "No person shall hold any office who, having previously served as an officer of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection." So here are the three core issues that the U.S. Supreme Court, with, as you know, 3 Trump appointees, may have to resolve. First, did Trump engage in insurrection? Special Counsel Jack Smith leveled 5 charges. 1, attempts to set aside valid election results with false claims of voter fraud. 2, unconstitutional efforts to have Mike Pence refuse to count the certified votes. And 3, lobbying Congress to reject unlawful votes. 4, incitement of a mob to forcibly prevent vote counting. And finally, 5, deliberate inaction during the January 6th attack despite having a duty to intervene. Now, based on oral argument, I think it seems likely that the court will try to bypass that question, did Trump engage in insurrection, and focus instead on a couple of other issues, one of which is whether the 14th Amendment's use of the term officer of the United States applies to Trump. Some legal scholars insist that only appointed but not elected officers are covered by the 14th Amendment, Section 3. The term office of president is used a half dozen times in the Constitution. Now, my sense is that the holder of an office must be an officer. Was President Nixon not an officer because he was elected, but his replacement, Gerald Ford, was an officer because he was appointed? And even more persuasive, if a president is impeached and convicted, the Constitution says he can be disqualified from holding, quote, any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. So plainly, in the impeachment clause, the president is an officer of the United States. I doubt that there's a persuasive rationale for that same term to be defined differently under Section 3. Finally, the third, and I think decisive, issue. Our Constitution is not a legal code. It's a set of broad principles that implement a framework for governance. And that's why many of its provisions have to be fleshed out by Congress in the form of enabling legislation. In this instance, there is a criminal statute that prescribes disqualification from office for rebellion or insurrection. But there's no statute enabling Section 3. Critics argue that Section 3 requires a statute before it can be executed. Moreover, Trump was never charged under the criminal statute, nor was he convicted for insurrection when he was impeached. But bear in mind, Section 3 does not mandate a criminal conviction, and it doesn't require proof beyond reasonable doubt. And further, even if Trump wasn't convicted by the Senate, he was charged with insurrection by the House, 232 to 197. And the Senate did vote to convict, 57 to 43, although short of the two-thirds majority required for a guilty impeachment verdict. Still, predictions are that a supermajority of the court will reverse Colorado's disqualification and hold that states cannot enforce Section 3 unless and until Congress has enacted enabling legislation. Even though our Constitution creates a republic and not a democracy, I believe the court will be sensitive to the notion that voters should decide whether Trump is fit to be president, especially without a criminal conviction and considerable uncertainty regarding a non-criminal application under Section 3. Imagine the outrage if one state, Colorado, or five unelected justices dictate who can be on the presidential ballot. Meanwhile, the Colorado decision has been stayed, and Trump can remain on the ballot while disqualification is pending in more than 17 states. Only one other state, Maine, has said Trump cannot be on the ballot. We should expect a Supreme Court decision before the Colorado and Maine primaries on Super Tuesday, which is March the 5th. Okay, that's it for seven of the most important pending cases. Thanks very much for your attention. And now I'm going to turn the mic over to Cato's Vice President for Development, Harrison Moore. Thanks very much.